أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. سبحان الذي أسرى بعبده ليلا من المسجد الحرام إلى المسجد الأقصى الذي باركنا حوله لنريه من آياتنا إنه هو السميع البصير. صدق الله العظيم. السلام عليكم my respected elders and friends. الحمد لله. Last week we discussed the period of Islamic empire or the Islamic period of Jerusalem. Within that, there were few points that I would like to highlight before we carry on. The first is what I mentioned last week, that at no time did the Muslims convert Jerusalem as their capital. And this was done in respect for the other faiths, so that they could not monopolize the city of Jerusalem and it would become accessible to other people. The second thing is that no time in the history of Jerusalem was there ever a conflict between the Muslims and the Jews. Never. Jerusalem, if anything, became a haven for the Jews and the Banu Israel after the liberation of the city by the Muslims. This is extremely important, because what's happening nowadays, people are trying to portray an image that there has always been a conflict in the city of Jerusalem. But this is not true. We have seen throughout the whole history of the city of Jerusalem and Philistine that at no time did the Muslims confront the Bani Israelites. Okay? If anything, the only problems that occurred was during about 100-year period of the Crusades and a short period thereafter at Mamluks and the Mongol invasion. But in between, there's absolutely no problems. Now, to understand the problems that we have today, how the state of Israel came into being, we really need to understand the Jewish people's life and livelihood in Europe and the greater world. So we're going to go away from the geographical area of Palestine and talk about Europe and the First World War. That will hopefully explain to us why and how Israel came into being. Now, throughout the Roman Empire, we studied that the Jews were greatly oppressed, and most of them had to leave the area of the Middle East and find refuge throughout Europe, Africa, and Europe. There was great oppression upon them. At nowhere within the European Empire did they find a haven to fruitfully exist as a good community. So much so that if anything happened in Europe, if there was a plague, there was an economic downturn, they always blamed that on the Jews. The Jews were the scapegoats for the Europeans. In Spain, to just give you a few examples so that we can get a picture of what was happening. In 1228, the Spanish passed a law forcing Jews to wear a distinctive badge so that they could be distinguished from everybody else. And they had to wear this. If they didn't, they would be punished. And some of them were actually killed for not doing this. Because of the oppression, the Jews decided to convert to Christianity or assimilate with the local population. But even through this, they didn't find any refuge, because they were given a title, a new name called the Marranos, and that means swine, literally in Spanish. So even by converting, they didn't find any help. Because of this, the oppression carried on in Spain. The Spanish Jews then had to evacuate and leave the country. Similar thing happened in Portugal. In England, it's amazing, in England, King Edward I not only robbed all the Jews, but he also expelled them out of Britain. In the city of York, they gathered all the Jews and put them in a citadel with the idea to burn them alive. But the Jews, to avoid being burnt alive, they committed mass suicide. And this was in England, in the city of York. The French followed suit and did the same to the Jews. While all this oppression was taking place in what we may call the Western Europe, what today is Western Europe, these Jews started moving out again from the European countries back onto the Islamic and the Ottoman Khilafah. And this is where they found refuge. But there's one amazing thing that happened. They settled in Morocco, they settled in Egypt, they settled in Turkey, they went to Iraq. Some of them went as far as South Africa, some went to America. A lot of them moved towards Russia, Hungary, and what we call the Eastern European areas. None of them went to Palestine. It's incredible. Although the heritage of the Jews was with Palestine, and they claimed the Bani Israel has a great heritage with Jerusalem, but none of them went to Jerusalem. The reason for this is quite simple. Because according to their books, a book called Halacha, it is like their fatwas, it says that no Jew can enter the city of Jerusalem before the coming of the Messiah. Because the Bani Israel believe that the final prophet has not arrived yet. And only after the coming of the final prophet can they, as a people, enter the city of Jerusalem as pure. To enter before that would be impure, and it would be the sacred place of Jerusalem would be destroyed. The sanctity would be destroyed. And this is very important. And this teaching carried on with the Jews, and that's why the Jews at no time tried to regain control of Jerusalem or mass migrated to Jerusalem. I'll give you a few examples of what was happening in Europe. In 1100 years, the year 1100, 1,500 Jews were killed in Germany. In 1228, as I mentioned earlier, all the Jews were expelled from Spain. In 1279, in Hungary, the church decreed that Jews must wear red cloth on their left-hand side. Again, you know, to distinguish them from the other people. In 1391, 50,000 Jews were killed in the island of Majorca. Okay. In 1391, Jews were massacred in Sicily. In 1399, the first persecution of Jews begins in Poland. Now, it's spreading throughout Europe. There is nowhere, a single place where the Jews could find themselves, any place where they could survive peacefully. In 1420, the Jewish community in Toulon in France was totally destroyed. In 1474, the Jews were massacred in Sicily. In 1498, there was not a single Jewish person left in Portugal. In 1541, and the list continues, Jews were destroyed from Naples in the area of Italy. All these problems, as I said earlier, for them to find refuge now was either the Ottoman Khalifa or what we now call Eastern European countries. But in 1789, something great happened to them, and they found a way of escape. A little bit of their oppression started being elevated. And that was through the French Revolution. In the French Revolution, the main essence that came out of the French Revolution was the establishment of nation states. Before that, the churches used to control the state. And basically, they were either colonialist empires or big dynasties. After the French Revolution, the church got separated from the state. So the state became a secular country, right? And the church had no interference within that country, the laws of the country. Because the church came out from the rules and regulations of the country, okay, the Jewish people started to thrive a little bit. The second thing that happened is the Protestant movement started to emerge during this time as well, 18th century. Now the Protestants believed that we should try and get all the Jews back to Palestine. The reason being is that if they go to Palestine, the Messiah will come. Right? And when the Messiah comes, he will convert the Jews to Christians. Okay? And this is the theology, this is the ideology between with the Protestants. That's why the Protestants are the closest allies of the state of Israel today. And the extreme version of Protestants are called Christian Zionists. They've actually been titled as Christian Zionists because they support the state of Zionism. During this period, after 1789, in the 1800s, again, Europe started suffering from economic downturn. Jewish persecution began. And in particular, things started getting worse in Russia. As from the list I gave you, we can deduce that there are very few now Jews left in France, Germany, Britain, Italy, that basically disappeared. The majority of the Jews had moved to Russia, Poland, Hungary, and in the Ottoman Empire. Now, there's two things that happened in Russia. First, there was a big economic downturn. And the second thing that happened was there was a revolution in which the Jews sided against the Tsar. So what the Tsar of Russia did was he basically masterminded the destruction of the Jews. And this is what is known as pogroms. You must have heard the word pogrom. And this is what it began. And the first pogrom was on 15th of April, 1881 in Russia. Okay. When this started happening, again, the Jews now had to move out of Russia because the persecution was tremendous. These pogroms carried on for 3 years until 1884. In this period, 2.5 million Jews from Russia emigrated out. Okay. How many were killed, I'm not too sure of. And to give you a definite, now we have actual statistics. Of the 2.5 million that left Russia and Poland, only 2.3% ended up in Palestine. Okay. Even at late stage of 1880, they still, the Jews, the mass Jews, did not believe in going to Jerusalem or Palestine or establishing a state for themselves. The reason I'm emphasizing this is I want to try and differentiate between Zionism and Judaism. These are two different entities, and we have to understand this. Very important for us to understand this point. However, those people who went to Palestine, okay, were called lovers of Zion. And they went there not because to establish a state, but because they had lived there with Sulaiman al-Islam, and they thought they could farm there and live in peace. And that was their main intention. There was no other intention at all. Around this period, again, there's one thing that happened. There was a trial in France of a person called Alfred Dreyfus. He was a colonel in the French army. An Austrian newspaper dispatched a man called Theodor Herzl, who was a journalist, to cover the story in France of this person, of how the French were treating Alfred Dreyfus. And he was amazed. When he came to France, he realized that the media was still anti-Semitic. Now, the word anti-Semitic here is very important for us, because since the Second World War, if you say anything against Israel, they'll jump on you and say you're anti-Semite. Anti-Semitic is anybody who is against the Judaic race, okay? Not Judaism as a religion, because we learned from the very first lecture, if you remember, that Arabs are Semites. So for Muslims, it's impossible to be an anti-Semitic, because then we will be against our own prophet, na'uzubillah. Okay? Because Arabs are descendants of Semitic people, and the Jews are descendants of the Arabs, as we discussed. Okay? So anti-Semitic is against a race, not Jewish as a religion. And this case highlighted the anti-Semitic within the French population, and Alfred Dreyfus was basically an innocent person. But the French army, because he was a Jew, accused him of a crime he did not commit and got in prison. This had a tremendous effect on Theodor Herzl. And he realized the only way to solve the Jewish problem were two routes. Either they want to assimilate and become part of European people and they forget their race and their religion, or second, totally cut away from Europe and create their own piece of land wherein they can live in peace. Because he knew there is nowhere in Europe the Jewish people would have peace and freedom and ability to prosper without having to look behind their backs. And this was the oppression that had, you know, started in the 1100s, that had carried on, moved to Russia. Now again it was returning back into Europe mainland, the Western European countries, just before the First World War. So Theodor Herzl, what he did, he called upon the Jewish elite, and they had the first Zionist conference in Basel in 1897. In this, he proposed his ideologies that we must create land for our people. And the first land they all agreed upon was to be Palestine, because that is the only land they could relate with. However, none of the Orthodox Jews, the Jews who were practicing the religion, attended this meeting. They boycotted it. Okay? And only a few hundred people attended this meeting. Again, it's very important to show you and to emphasize this point, that although the Zionist, and Theodor Herzl, although he was a Jew, he was not a practicing Jew, he was a secularist. He basically did not care much about Judaism as a religion. And this is a fact, a known fact. Anyway, at this meeting, Theodor Herzl was made the chairman of the organization, and then he was appointed the task of finding a country, and in particular, if possible, Palestine as a land for the Jews to go towards. Theodor Herzl was as a contemporary person, he knew the politics of the area, the situation, and he knew there were three main players. The first were the Germans, the second were the British, and the third, obviously, was the Ottoman Caliph himself, at the time, who was Abdul Hamid. So the first thing he did was go to the Germans. Now, I just want to diverge a little bit here. Now, this period is just before the First World War. Okay, 1897, 1900, we're just moving towards the breaking of the First World War. During this period, in the world, what was happening is there was an industrial revolution. Europe was producing more goods than it could consume. So it needed a market to sell these goods. And the market, the rich market at that time was the Ottoman Empire, Africa, and India and Asia. For all this to happen, they had to go through the Ottoman Caliphate. To go to Africa, to the mainland, or use the seaport, they had to use their area. To go to India, especially, they either had to go mainland through Iraq and Palestine, or through the sea, through the Suez Canal. Again, they had to use Ottoman Caliphate territory. So basically, the idea to destroy the Ottoman Caliphate and to gain territory for themselves had come very, very early on, even before the First World War. And there were two main groups, Britain, France on one side, and on the other side, so Britain, France, and Russia on one side, this is just before First World War, and on the other side, we had Germany, the Austria-Hungarian Empire, and the Italians. So there were the two main camps, and these two camps were competing each other. So Germany was in conflict with Britain. So Theodor Herzl first goes to Germany and puts a proposal forward if they could assist him in establishing a state. They did not entertain his idea. He left very quickly from Germany. The second thing he did is he went to Turkey. Now look at the audacity of the man. He is a person going to a Muslim Khalifa, right? And what he does there, at that time, the Ottoman Caliph was waning, economically it was very weak. So he said, we have got a lot of rich people, and one in particular, Lord Rothschild. Today, the Rothschild industry and the investment company is one of the biggest in the world, and they were big at that time. There was at that time also an emergence of banking system. Up until then, there wasn't a banking system as we know it today. Okay, but this is another lecture. It's very, very important how the banking system began. So Theodor Herzl went to Abdul Hamid, the Khalifa, and said, give us Palestine. We will underwrite all your debts, and we will monitor and control your economy for you, just for giving Palestine. Now, the benefits, it doesn't matter how weak the Khalifa is, but the benefit of the Ummah having a single head who is on the right path, that must be emphasized, is an answer that Abdul Hamid gave. Abdul Hamid told him that you can give me all the wealth the Jewish people have got, and I will not give you even the sand that can come into my fist to you. Okay? And he knew that by not doing this, and he was collapsing, he knew the Ottoman Caliph was collapsing, this is now into 1903, 1902. And he further said, and this is quoted by the person who was with them, he said that I know, is Abdul Hamid saying, that I know there is a possibility you will gain Palestine, but it will be after our blood has been spilled and not before them. So basically you're saying you're prepared to sacrifice our lives, but we will not sell you Jerusalem. Disappointed, Theodor Herzl doesn't give up his ambitions, and he goes to Britain. To Britain, there was an amazing thing happening. The Russian pogroms was forcing all the Jews now back to Britain and France. And although the government wasn't too much concerned, there was an uproar amongst the people. So much so that there was a commission of investigation against the immigration of what was known as the aliens at the time. And this investigation, a royal commission, was to find a solution against the Jews entering Britain. And in this commission, Theodor Herzl came and gave evidence to tell the British how he could help them solve their problem. Okay, do you understand what I'm trying to say here? It's very important, this point. So Theodor Herzl tells the British that we know you have a problem with the Jews in your country. The way to solve the problem is to give us land within the great British Empire, wherein the Jews could live, and that would automatically, with a single stroke, solve the Jewish problem in your countries, in Europe as a whole, not just Britain. And it is amazing who supported him at that point. The first people to support him was a person called Chamberlain. Now, Chamberlain was renowned, and he's on record as being an anti-Semite. He hated the Semites. And he was the first one, and he was at the time in the Foreign Colonial Office, and he supported Theodor Herzl. Why? Not because he liked the Zionists, not because he liked the Jewish ideology, it's because he hated them. And he wanted to solve his problem to get rid of the Jews. So now we see marriage of convenience to get rid of the Jews from the European Empire to create a state for them. There were several proposals put forward, Argentina, Cyprus, Egypt, all this were looked at, but they were not very serious. The most serious proposal that was put forward to Theodor Herzl was Uganda. Yeah. Uganda was put forward, and at that time, present-day Kenya also included Uganda. Theodor Herzl was over the moon about this. He thought, now we have a possibility to take all the European Jews out of Europe, and we'll have a land in what we call today Uganda. He called up another meeting. Another meeting was set up in Basel for the Zionists, and he put this proposal forward, and he put it such in a strong way. Majority of the people who attended that conference were the Orthodox, secular Zionists, Orthodox, but secular Zionists from Poland and Russia. And they basically said, the only solution we want is Palestine. It's either Palestine or we're not going anywhere. And the one main person who was against him was Cham Wiseman. Wiseman was against Theodor Herzl's proposal of Uganda. Theodor Herzl, disappointed, returns from this conference and tries, and again comes to the British and tries more for towards moving towards Palestine. However, in 1904, Theodor Herzl dies. And Cham Wiseman now, who was a pro person towards moving the Jews towards Palestine, becomes the leader of Zionists. He was a Russian. Immediately after he becomes the chairman of the Zionist movement, he moves to Britain. This is 1904, 1906, and anywhere between that period. He was also a chemist and a lecturer. He was appointed a lecturership at the University of Manchester. Okay. Now, during that period, between 1904, when he was appointed, and the First World War breaking up, 1914, they did not just stay stagnant. They tried all the avenues to try and influence the British government and anybody who could basically listen to them to give them Palestine. Okay. As terms of event worked out, in the First World War, when First World War broke out, Britain used to manufacture something called acetone from timber. And acetone was used in ammunition, in making certain form of ammunition that was used in the war front battle. However, Britain started running down of timber, and they had a difficulty of producing this acetone. So they started looking for a chemist who could synthetically manufacture acetone. And that was a speciality of Wiseman. So Wiseman then helped the British government during the First World War to produce acetone. Now, because he now entered the Ministry of Defense, he had the ears of the government. He was now mingling with the ministers and the leaders, and he became very close friends with a person called Alfred Belfer. Alfred Belfer is the main person we'll see in a few minutes how he assisted the Zionists. Now, the second thing that was happening is Britain wanted America to take part in the First World War, and America refused initially. They wanted to stay neutral. So he used the Zionists, who were at the time, even as early as the First World War, quite influential within American political system, to get America involved so that America could have a hand in defeating the Germans and the Italians. So there's a second role of the Zionists. The third thing that happened is now the Ottoman Khilafah was collapsing. Okay. The collapse of Ottoman Khilafah required a creation of not only nation states, as we learned from last week, because the British had promised the Muslims that if you assist us against the Ottoman Caliphate, we will give you national status. You will have your own land and you can become a nation state and you will prosper and you do not have to have a Khalifa system. So they had created the secular ideology within the Arabs. So they promised the Arabs nation states. They had promised the Jews, pretty soon we'll come to that, Palestine. And within themselves, the Europeans, particularly between France and Britain, they had signed up the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which said basically that once we destroy the Ottoman Caliphate, we will carve up the Middle East on a certain plan base. Okay? Now the Zionists had to prove to the British that they could be a force to not only destroy the Ottoman Caliphate, but if they were implemented in the Middle East, they would forever play a pivotal role against the disunity of the Muslims. This was an ideal opportunity for Britain to plant Zionism in the state of Israel in Palestine. So it acted not only as a buffer state for them, so that the Muslims could never rise again, but there would be a derisory and a divisive element forever. Okay? And there would be the first check against any Muslim unity. And that is why the issue of Palestine, Muslims are suffering everywhere, but that is why the issue of Palestine is so important for the Ummah, and to understand it, that the creation of State of Israel is instrumental in the destruction of the unity of the Ummah. Okay? This was happening, as we learned last week, the Ottoman Caliphate was destroyed, and it is very interesting to learn that during all this period, while the Zionists were talking to them, when Britain took over Palestine, and Palestine becomes a mandate, British mandate, I would like to take you back a few years. On November 17th, 2nd of November, Balfour, who was now the Prime Minister of Britain, writes a letter to Lord Rothschild, and he states in his letter, just read you a small sentence, that His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and it will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. Okay. This letter is quoted even today by the Zionists and the Israelis to justify the creation of the State of Israel. The date I quoted is very important, November 2nd, 1917. This was before the end of the First World War, before the Ottoman Empire officially had signed armistice. In effect, Britain was giving Palestine to a third people, to a country it did not belong to them. In other words, November 2nd, 1917, Palestine did not belong to the British. Okay. Yet, they gave it to the Zionists. And it's amazing. I mean, no human being can give one thing that does not belong to him to another person. No human being who is sane and just can also accept something from a first person, an object or an item that does not belong to him. And this is just normal common sense. Yet here we have a scenario that Britain, which had no sovereign right to Palestine, was given the Zionists a state, right, a homeland, and to Britain the state did not belong. So who are they to give the Zionists the state? An amazing question arises. In international law, I think this would just fall apart. What we need to do is emphasize the state, learn our points of history, and pick on this. Okay? Because there's nowhere in international law that one person can give somebody else something that does not belong to him. He simply has no right. You know, the Palestinian people were not asked about this. Britain just simply gave it. After the First World War, there was a great debate of what to do with all the land they had occupied, especially the Ottoman land. America comes into play and they invite the President of America, and a big peace conference takes place in France. In this peace conference, several things emerges. The first, the creation of League of Nations. The League of Nations gets created after the First World War. In 1922, the League of Nations gives Britain the mandate over Palestine. Okay? Only a mandate. Now, what does a mandate mean? The people of Palestine were given Category A by the League of Nations. What that means is that the Palestinian people were the most matured towards establishing a state. The mandate, the power of the mandate was the British to ensure that these people can't get their nation. So the job of the Britain or the British Empire was to facilitate for the Palestinians a nation. And this is what the League of Nations was there for, and this is what the mandate was there for. Yet Britain used its mandate to get the Jews of Europe into Palestine and convert it into Israel. So they basically abrogated their responsibility. Not only that, they connived against the Palestinians, against their rights. Okay. So this is amazing on international law. Again, some points we need to ponder. A few things that might arise into our minds is what was happening to the Arab world at the time. I want you to just ponder, create their own country. And the first and foremost on this was somebody called Husseini, who had correspondent with the British and who aided the British most. Husseini was ruling the area of Hijaz, present-day Mecca, Saudi Arabia. As soon as the First World War finished, Husseini himself declared the king of Saudi, king of Hijaz. When he did that, Ibn Saud Abdul Aziz, who was then the head of Najd and the head of the Wahhabi movement, attacked Husseini. Okay? Husseini was defeated in 1924. He had to abdicate, and then Abdulaziz takes over the kingdom of Hijaz, proclaims himself king of Hijaz and Najd, and then later on changes the name to Saudi Arabia after his surname, Ibn Saud, and therefore Saudi Arabia. So Saudi really is the name, surname of Ibn Saud. Okay? And this finished in 1932. So between 1909, or the first end of First World War, 1918-1919 to 1932, the people living around Hijaz were basically engulfed in their own problem. Okay, they had major problems in their own hand. If we look at the other countries, if we look at Syria, Syria was given over to the French. The French were controlling Syria. And during the Second World War, when Germany occupied France, the Syrians managed to reoccupy their territory over from the French. But the British then aided the few French soldiers who were in Middle East and reoccupied it again and brought it under French control. The Syrians did not get independence until 1943. Okay? So basically the whole population around Syria basically made disabled, if we like. Similar thing happened in Iraq. Now in Iraq, there was oil. Oil was discovered, the actual pumping of the oil took place in 1927. At what stage the British knew of this oil is very difficult to say. Whether they knew it around 1919, 1924, you know, people argue about that. But it is sure to say they knew about oil in Iraq immediately after the First World War. So what they did to Iraq is they made Iraq a very big country. Now the problem with this was, because it was a very huge geographical area, it had a lot of different people from different tribes. And they appointed Faisal, who was the son of Husseini in Hijaz, as the first king of Iraq. Now they brought somebody from Hijaz, made him king of Iraq. Because Faisal did not have ground support, he had to ask the British to protect him. The British remained in Iraq. Eventually, they drilled oil in Iraq, and that oil company belonged to Britain. And they basically controlled everything until the mid-1950s. So Iraq, again, is out of the equation to help anything to do with Palestine. We come to Jordan. Jordan was created after the First World War. There was no such country called Jordan. Anything west of River Jordan became Jordan. East of River Jordan became Palestine. And Abdullah, another son of Husseini, Hijaz, was given the kingdom of Jordan. Jordan was basically a barren desert. I mean, the joke that Amman was a village for nomads, you know, that is how poor Jordan was. So again, they're out of the equation. They did not get independence till late 1920s, about 28, 29. Egypt, which is the biggest and the most powerful country in the Middle East at the time, and even now most probably had several problems. I would like to just go back a bit on Egypt. In 1798, during the French Revolution, Napoleon attacked Egypt. Okay, Egypt was conquered. The first country to go to the Europeans away from the Ottoman Caliphate was Egypt. When that happened, the Khalifa dispatched somebody called Muhammad Ali, who was an Albanian. And he reconquered or reoccupied Egypt in 2 years, in the year 1800. What this had shown, this occupation by Napoleon, was the Ottoman Empire was not as strong as it seemed. And this opened up the gates for the other European future adventures. And it also whet the appetites of the Europeans. And they found out within that 2 years, the wealth within Egypt. And to just indicate just one example, if you go to any museum in the world there, not just Europe only, anywhere, you will find artifacts from Egypt. They robbed the pharaoh's tombs, any wealth they could find from Egypt, and they brought it into Europe and Americas. And they stripped it down. The British, wanting the link to go to India, and especially after the Suez Canal was built in 1869, they occupied Egypt. And they remained in Egypt until, I think, 1954. That is when Egypt got its independence. So again, Egypt is disengaged and away from the central problem of Palestine. However, you might have thought while all this collapse, the Palestinians, the few Palestinians now that are living there, the population of Palestine was very, very small, approximately 750,000, if that, at the turn of the First World War. You would have thought that the Jewish people would run towards Israel. The British were facilitating them to move there, but this did not take place. By 1932, there were only around 1,000 Jews in Palestine. This is a census. 1931, only 174,000. The reason being is even up to this stage, in the 1931 stage, the Jewish people who are religious did still not want to go to Israel or create the state of Israel because of the halacha, because it was against their laws to do this. It was only the Zionists who were the secularists who wanted to create a state for themselves, were the ones who are forcing the Jewish people to move out of Europe and create a land of Palestine, or to create Israel in the land of Palestine. While all this was taking place, the Palestinians themselves were so naive, it's incredible. The first thing they did after the collapse, or after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and the British Mandate, they started calling up meetings, and in the very first meeting in the 1919, I think it was February or March, the first thing they requested Britain to do is to maintain Bilad al-Sham, the greater area of Sham, that is Syria, Jordan, and Palestine. And they say, don't separate us. We want to be one country. And this is the naivety of the Palestinians, because they did not foresee this. If you think about up until then, they were being controlled by a Khalifa who had a state system, and they were just citizens. For them, it was not necessary to request a nation, and they were not particularly concerned about nationalism either. The naivety even shows further that during the 1920s, 21, 22, they sent a delegation to Britain. Palestinians, a delegation came to Britain to tell Britain and sort of reason with them, to say, look, this is our land, you know, the Jews who are here, who have come, we're willing to stay with them as one people. But, you know, Britain would not have any of this. They got a cold shoulder, a deaf ear, and they were sent packing back home. Things were getting hot. Within Palestine, the few Jews who had arrived were very arrogant. The land they had bought, and the land they had bought, this is very important, was not from the Palestinians. This is a myth. Most of the land that the Jewish people got was from the British. The British actually either sold it to them or gave it to them. We will come to the percentage, inshallah, in our next lecture, when the UN petition comes in. But the Palestinian problems started arising, the crisis between the Palestinian Muslims and Christians and the Jewish people, or the Zionists in particular, because they're very, very aggressive now. a point came when they started having demonstration, and they had one very big demonstration in Tel Aviv, in which they started shouting that Al-Buraq wall, which is one of the walls along the wall of Masjid Al-Aqsa, belongs to them. After that, they started bringing chairs and started putting curtains by the Al-Buraq wall. This got the Palestinians very suspicious as to what they were up to. This led to a big demonstration, and basically a riot erupted in which a lot of people died, both on Palestinian side and on the Jewish side. But what the British did was amazing. What the British did was they arrested approximately, I think it was 700 people, of which 600 were Palestinians and around 100 were Jews. Of all the Jews they arrested, they released them. Of the Palestinians, they actually hanged 3 people. And this is the justice, even as early as 1929 we're talking about. But the Al-Buraq wall incidents highlighted something big. Because of the conflict, the League of Nations now had to determine to whom does the Al-Buraq wall belong. And this document is very important for us today, because this was carried out by a European power to determine to whom does this wall belong. And they unanimously decided that the Al-Buraq wall belongs to the Muslims, and it is waqf. And it is a right, and the Muslims have the right and the custodianship of this wall. And they only allow Jews to pray there because they so desire. And this was according to the League of Nations. Now, if they're going to bring documents like the Balfour Declaration for us, then we have to also bring in League of Nations documents that actually tell us that the Al-Buraq wall, which is part of Masjid Al-Aqsa, belongs to us. So the main claim of theirs is being refuted by the non-Muslims, by the League of Nations.
After the First World War,
a very big document for us is something called the King Crane Commission. The American president commissioned these two people, King and Crane, to find out what did the Palestinian people want, this conflict in Palestine, how can we resolve it? And it is amazing what happened. Before the peace conference in Paris, the American Jews gave a letter to the president to say that we know you're going to discuss the issue of Palestine, and we would like to let you know that the American Jews do not wish to create a state for the Jews in Palestine. And this document, again, still exists. It's a historical document. Again, because the Jewish people who believed in their religion had got nothing to do with nationhood. They were not secular Jews. They were not after creating a state. It was only the Zionists, people who had political ambitions to create a state for themselves. Anyway, the King Crane Commission, basically, after having visited Palestine and asked all the people in Palestine, recorded just 2 points which I shall record to you. That 90% of Palestinian inhabitants were non-Jewish, 90% at that time, and they did not want a Jewish state in Palestine. The second point they say, that a Jewish state in Palestine would violate the Palestinian rights to self-determination. If you remember League of Nations, what the League of Nations wanted to do was Britain to facilitate a self-rule for the Palestinians. Okay? And this document, again, basically refutes Balfour Declaration, which promised the Jews a homeland in Palestine. So we have other documents, American documents, and the League of Nations documents against the British government's wishes. But the British government then sold its ideas of this creation of the state, which should not only be beneficial towards solving European Jewish problem, to get Europe out of, the Jews out of Europe, but it also, the state of Israel then would be a means by which it would disintegrate the Muslims forever. And this is how we now get between the First World War we started today up until 1929. And I would like to end here today, because there's a lot of information, and inshallah, Allah willing, will carry on not next week, but the week after that. And this is how basically Britain and European powers manipulated and used Jews first to solve their own problem at home, the local problem, then their international ambition. Because there's 2-prong effects here. They're fulfilling their international ambition of maintaining their hegemony, as it's known, to maintain British power in the world. okay, by implanting this foreign entity in the heart of Muslim lands, okay, and at the same time solving the European problem, the problem of the British people who hated the Jews, so that they could get the Jews out of their countries and put them somewhere else. Jazakallah khairan.